It's Thursday, June the 25th, day 96, and I've got laryngitis. This lends an air of suspense to what follows. Will I make it to the end? Will you? Anyway, crises play a critical role in the evolution or decay of democracies. That's because, in contrast to scandals, they lead to structural change. When the banks collapsed so spectacularly in 2008, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer was afraid that the ATM machines would not dispense cash on Monday morning, most of us thought that this was going to be the defining crisis of our lives. We were wrong. It turned out to be a scandal, not a crisis. Although it led to some regulatory and other changes, it basically left the financial services industry to do its own thing. Banks had to hold more capital as reserves, they had to undergo stress tests, and so on. But in most other ways, they were allowed to get up to new kinds of mischief. The chief of these has been the invention of a new kind of toxic derivative called the collateralized loan obligation, or CLO, which is basically bundles of corporate debt given a high score by ratings agencies. But given that many of those debts are owed by companies that are likely to disappear in the post-pandemic depression, we can expect another repetition of 2008. Only now, states won't have the resources to bail out the banks, because they've already been bailing out their societies. History repeats itself, as Marx might have said. The first time as tragedy, the second time as catastrophe. So is the coronavirus then a crisis? On the face of it, yes. The whole world has ground to a halt. Neoliberal governments are spending money like drunken Marxists on a night out. Citizens are huddled, frightened in their caves, fearing to go out. And all because of a molecule a micron in diameter. Given the way that the virus has revealed how fragile, unequal and unsustainable our societies had become, surely, surely we won't go back to that way of living. Anthony Barnett has written a fine essay on the Open Democracy website, in which he thinks that this time the crisis is profound enough to lead to far-reaching and structural change. Basically, he thinks we're witnessing the end of the neoliberal state because the pandemic has forced it to choose between the imperatives of the market and the safety and well-being of their citizens. And they have chosen the people for a change. It's a fine essay, worth reading in full, and I devoutly hope he's right in thinking that this is a pivotal moment in democratic history. But to be honest, I have a lot of nagging doubts. One stems from the memory of 2008 and its aftermath, when there was a moment when many people thought that the economic and political regimes that had allowed the banks to get away with such unbridled larceny would surely be stopped. It didn't happen. What happened instead is that the banks were bailed out, their colossal losses were socialized, that is to say, imposed on citizens in the form of austerity and welfare cuts, while the inordinate rewards of banking continued to be privatized. Another reason for doubt comes from reading Philip Murawski's great book, Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste, How Neoliberalism Survived the Financial Meltdown, which is about how governments fell back on neoliberal ideas to solve the problems that neoliberalism had created. And guess what happened? Neoliberalism as an ideology of ruling elites and democracies emerged strengthened from the wreckage of the catastrophe it had midwifed into existence. Then there's my intuition, call it fear, that the corporations that emerge unscathed or even enhanced by the coronavirus crisis will all be large transnational ones. And finally, there's the real giveaway. When you look at the financial aid extended by governments in the Anglosphere, that's the UK and the US, you find that it has been provided in wholly unconditional ways. In return for government aid on a colossal scale, corporations have been asked for nothing in return. And as with the banks in 2008, they have seen no reason why the downturn in their businesses as a result of the virus should cramp their style. Take, for example, the American Airlines, which made no provision for reserves during the fat years, preferring to use their profits to boost executive bonuses, pay out lush dividends to shareholders, and engage in share buybacks on a lavish scale to boost their stock market valuations. Then the virus strikes, and suddenly all their planes are grounded. Shortly afterwards, trucks stuffed with cash arrive from Uncle Sam. What happens? Trebles all run for the boardroom, dividends galore, and maybe even more share buybacks. The only consolation in this grim scenario is that the Anglosphere appears largely to be a demented law unto itself. Elsewhere in Europe, more rational and sensible counsels have prevailed. When airlines are bailed out, they have to produce strategies for decarbonisation. When factories are helped, they have to produce strategies for reskilling, staff training, induction of apprentices, and so on. In other words, what in normal societies passes for common sense, but which in the UK and the US is regarded as rocket science, understood only by boffins and pointy-headed intellectuals who don't understand neoliberal reality. I hope to God I've got this wrong and that Anthony Barnett is right. Unfortunately, only time will tell.